Welcome to Barbara Irvine's First Oral History. I'm Jack Ford, and this oral history was recorded for the Actors Fund's Performing Arts Legacy Project on October 14th, 2019 at HB Studio in New York.
Hello.
Great. So we're just going to talk a little bit about your background.
Okay.
Tell me about your family, your childhood. What got you interested in what would become your work?
It's quite possible, because I came from a family of performers, that had some influence on me. My father was a community theater actor and an oratorio singer, and he was a member of two semi-professional choruses in the area. I say semi-professional, I don't know if they were paid or not, but they performed a lot. And then he was a paid soloist on a church choir. So my mother considered herself a performer's widow. She was always sitting in the audience watching him perform, and I was with her. And we went to concerts. I started going at a very early age. My mother got permission for me to see concerts when I was six. I was under the age that was allowed, but I was very well behaved and I listened to the music. And this was classical at that time. And also, I grew up in a church that did shows. We had a wonderful organist choir director who could play the piano. I always say like a Baptist, even though we were Lutheran, but she could, you know, use all the keys on all 88 of them. And we did shows, and one of the things, may I refer to Mapping the Legacy? One of the things in my Mapping the Legacy is the Tom Thumb wedding I was in at the age of four. And that was my first public performance that I recall. My sister and I were always called upon to perform for visiting relatives and that sort of thing in the house. But this is the first time I remember publicly performing, and I played Dale Evans and sang Happy Trails to You with Tony South, who played Roy Rogers. So, and also my father was Santa Claus on the radio for 30 years in Hagerstown, so I hope people under a certain age are not listening to this, and I ruin it for them. But does that give you some answer to that?
It does. And then growing up, did you play specific instruments? If you play multi-instruments, when did you add them on? What's your favorite? Tell me about that.
Okay, my sister is 4 years older than I, and she started piano at the age of six. My mother wisely waited until I requested it. She didn't force me into it, and I didn't ask until I was eight. And so when I was eight, I began piano lessons, and we were fortunate to have a very good piano teacher who had a certificate from the Peabody Conservatory and had very good training from the age of eight until I graduated from high school with the same piano teacher. And then in those days, there was more music in the schools than there is now. You know, and so we had good choral groups and we had good orchestras and that sort of thing. So I was performing, singing in some of the vocal groups and then sometimes playing piano for them. But I was not involved in theater, interestingly enough. And it's my life's blood. I don't know how that happened, that I got to it later.
When did you get to it?
Well, I guess the first, because I could project my voice, my father taught me how to project my voice without yelling. I did play a witch in an elementary school play, and I said, unless my witch's eyes deceive me, something of that sort. And then later, because my dad was Santa Claus on the radio, they had me play Santa Claus in junior high. Really weird, like, logic there, but anyway, I played Santa Claus. It was double cast. I and a fellow were Santa Claus in this multi-production. Santa's in a sleigh and visits Christmas all over the world. So that was junior high school. But then, you know, I didn't do any onstage work again until undergraduate school, and I played a cigarette girl in Carmen just because I thought it would be fun. And I got great respect from musical theater people at that point because I knew the music hands down. And then when they started choreographing it and having us do things while we were singing, totally went out of my head. So I get that now, and that makes me more sympathetic when I vocal coach and that sort of thing.
So how did you get to vocal coaching, music transcribing, that side of music rather than performing?
I would say the first show that I played for a show, again a Christmas one in junior high, and they just had me playing Green Sleeves over and over again, and I, you know, hated Green Sleeves for years because I had to play it so many times. So in a way, I was music directing, but not really at that point. And then, let's see. I guess I went to graduate school in applied piano. and got a little irritated with my classical colleagues because they seemed to be so narrow-minded. And that's not the case as much now, and maybe it was just the particular group I was with. Maybe it wasn't even then. And I just wanted to get away from them, and I found it too isolating, and have learned since that I'm a collaborative artist. That's what I enjoy the most, and that's what I thrive on. And I was living in Texas at the time. I was going to the University of Texas. And when I dropped out of graduate school, I had various jobs, and eventually got a master's degree in business at night. I was, you know, just making a living. And then two things happened. I started playing for this little opera company and enjoyed it so much, but it was after hours. It didn't interfere with my day job. And then also the accompanying budget at the University of Texas went bust, and students were having to hire their own piano players for their lessons and for their concerts. And I was dating a guy that was in graduate school at the University of Texas at that time, and he told me about it. So I would take vacation hours and go play for these people, and eventually then, and then also he was conducting a community orchestra, and I played a Bach concerto with them. So I got back to it, and I quit my day job and took a 150% cut in salary, something like that. It was like a 75% cut in salary, and went back into it full time. I'm gonna go on a tangent. You said you'd like tangents.
Yeah, I love tangents.
That first summer I earned, that's where that 150 comes from. I earned $150 the entire summer. And I had taken my retirement out. It was just a couple of $1,000, and because I wasn't vested yet, and I could just pull it out. And I was watching the Jerry Lewis telethon, and one of the Annie girls, it wasn't Andrea McCardle, it was whoever was playing at that time, came on and sang Tomorrow, and I sobbed, and it inspired me, like, it's gonna be okay. I don't have to go back and get a day job. And so then, from then on, I was freelance, and decided to stick with it. And as one of our colleagues was discussing earlier today, had the good fortune of my parents decided to share the wealth before they died. So they gave me and my sister, at first it was $3,000 a year, and then it was $4,000 a year. And I took mine in increments every month, you know, like $300 a month or something like that. Makes an amazing amount of difference, particularly in the 70s, late 70s. It was extremely helpful, and it enabled me to continue as a freelance musician.
So you had support from your family, both financially, but also to pursue this?
More so from my mother than my dad. My dad was always very conservative and practical, and always wanted to know what was going to happen next and what was guaranteed, which of course nothing is, but in his mind, you know, his day job was steady and, you know, all that sort of thing. And then the impetus also about getting to theater, I just decided to start applying for everything I saw listed, and they needed someone to come in and play piano for the boyfriend at a small theater in Austin. And I applied for it. And we did a barter thing because I needed a new answering machine and she had one she was trying to sell. And so we bartered for part of that. So I got the answering machine. And it kind of went from there then, as far as I started to work my way into the Austin theater scene, which was quite dynamic and is so today.
And so you took a risk by switching to completely freelance. And do you think that paid off? How did that pay off within both the Texas scene, and I'm assuming you moved to New York after that.
Yes.
So how did that factor in taking that risk?
It was so fulfilling. It's who I am, I guess. And risk taker sounds it could sound like a bragging thing. It's not. It's just who I am. I don't know any other way. And I love it. And I love not knowing what was going to happen next. Whereas as a child, you know, I always wanted to know what was going to happen next. You know, I needed that security. But I love that. I love it. I miss that because I'm not doing as much of it anymore. But, you know, I'd never know, like, oh, I'm never going to work again. I'm never going to work again. And then the phone rings and there's a job, you know, love it.
It's funny how that works.
Yes. Right? Yes.
So then going back, if I heard correctly, you dropped out of school.
Out of graduate school.
Tell me about that. What was that decision? Where was that based?
I had been, it was a couple of things. A part of it was social. I had been a scholastic ascetic from the second semester of my freshman undergraduate year to through the first year of graduate school. And I decided I wanted to have a little fun, for one thing. And also, as I mentioned, my colleagues, it was not, they were not my people. You know, I've since learned that theater people are my people. But and I have close classical musician friends, but, you know, I'm more at home with my theater friends.
And have you found that throughout the years, not having finished that program has affected you in any way? Do you wish you had stuck it out for the degree? Or do you think that it played out the way it needed to and you were great?
I think it played out the way it needed to. And the University of Texas had this wonderful thing. If it hadn't been 7 years since the last class you took, you were still considered a graduate student. And so I went back, and if I had concerts I was giving, I would go back and take piano lessons through the university, which was much cheaper than taking them privately. And then I went back and took composition, but I did it as a songwriter, and the professors loved it. They said, oh, thank heaven, somebody's writing a song. You know, because people would come in and write this atonal stuff that was academic and, anyway, not what I would write. So I did that. So I utilized it also. For you have to learn these things. I utilized it so if I was enrolled in the University of Texas, I could do the student insurance. See how I did that?
Yeah. Clever.
Yes.
And so it seems also like having that real world experience has informed your academic life too, with how when you would come back, you would utilize it in a different way.
Right. It could also work against me occasionally, but I had this wonderful piano teacher at the University of Texas, but at one point there was something I played and she said, you play that like a hack theater pianist or theater piano player. And I went, ooh, okay, gotcha. Mm-hmm. But
so then tell me about your journey to New York.
Okay. I had always known I wanted to move here, and I pretty much, with the exception of a couple of things in my life, tried never to do anything till I was ready. And I wasn't ready, and I wasn't ready, and I was working in Austin, you know, as a freelance musician, and wonderful atmosphere, 6,000 working artists in Austin, Texas, very collaborative, very, very mutually supportive. And even to the point that I kept my cats indoors, which was something you didn't do in those days, everybody had their cats roaming around, because I wanted them to be ready to be apartment cats when I was ready to move to New York. And then the economy went south in Texas because the oil prices dropped. This was in 1988. And I had applied to be a park ranger at Wolf Trap Performing Arts Park, working backstage. You still had to be a park ranger to do that. And I was 42 at the time. And they tried every which way to get around me, but legally they couldn't get around me. They were worried about my age. It was just everybody that summer. And that was when I decided, okay, the time is now, I am moving to New York City. So I went back to Austin and music directed a couple of shows and then left in December. I went back to Austin in September and left in December of 1988. And, you know, I had a friend, a house sitting for me, you know, for pay. I mean, he rented my house basically. And then, you know, stopped by my mother's on the way to New York and, had an agreement with a friend to stay for 2 weeks, and then eventually ended up dog sitting for 6 weeks, and then eventually found my own place.
And you stayed for 15 years.
15 years.
And then how did it translate being a freelancer in Austin to now being a freelancer in New York City?
There were some things that happened that I didn't expect. I did not expect. In Austin, I was a music director. But up here, I was a woman who wanted to be a music director, and I was surprised at that. I didn't expect that. I thought the gender thing would not be in play as much as it was. It didn't hurt me terribly, but I was just surprised that I didn't. Anyway,
you were aware of it, so to speak.
I was aware of it, yeah. But it's gotten so much better. I mean, there are women music directing on Broadway now, all that sort of stuff. But it was very unusual when I first moved here for a woman to want to do that or to be that, and. And then also, I didn't quite understand the way union worked, and I thought they just got us work. That's not the way that works. you join the union to be protected, and they've got your back. But and I love 802. I'm a major fan of Local 802. But it wasn't quite what I expected there either. So, you know, I learned some things moving here. But a lot of it is the same, the networking, all that. That's where all the jobs come from, is that networking. And then eventually word of mouth once you've networked enough. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell me about a favorite moment that you had when you were living in New York.
Oh my goodness, there's so many. It was the 15 best years of my life. A favorite moment. I'll have to think about that. I mean, that might be a separate oral history.
Yeah. Great.
Because there are just so many. Mm-hmm. Do you want to characterize a type of moment, and then maybe I can come up with something?
I guess let's do, rather than a specific moment, what, give me like a typical work day for you in New York City at the time.
I just thought of a favorite moment.
Oh, then give me your favorite moment.
There's so many thrills. You know, it's thrilling that the people I am trying to meet or have met or who call me or whatever were only names to me when I was in Austin or when I was a child. And now, you know, I'm becoming a colleague or may become a colleague or whatever. It's just thrilling to me. And I learned so much from people who've been in the business that long, you know. But I had the great honor and privilege of working with the chanteuse Julie Wilson. And she was singing a song on one of the Donnell Library songbook programs for which I was the pianist. And so that's when I first met her. And then she was later performing at Rainbow and Stars, and she said, be sure to let Bismarck, who was the Maitre d', yes, host, whatever, know, let him know that you're there, and he will tell me. And I did. And she's going around introducing celebrities in the audience, and she said, and I want to introduce a young pianist, Barbara Irvine. And she had me stand up, I'm getting chills thinking about it, and said, remember this name, you're going to hear more from her. She's a brilliant pianist and musician, something of that sort. Oh my goodness, that was so thrilling. And I had just, you know, I hadn't been here that long. Yeah, thrilling. And we stayed friends until she passed away, so yeah, thrilling.
Wow. So I'm going to end on that high note.
All right, let's do.
Awesome. Thanks for chatting.
Thank you so much.